History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold, and they don't have to go untold. As long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then commit a little time to patiently listen as memories that may not have seen the light of day for a while start to present themselves again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories, so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We get to meet another World War II Marine today who is barreling toward the century mark in a small California town, 99-year-old George Kincaid. I have a feeling that the town where you live is probably one of the most frequently mispronounced places to live. Tell us how to say your hometown.
Nukuyama. It's an Indian word for clam.
What's the funniest mispronunciation of it you've heard?
A Q. They use a Q instead of a, yeah, Nuku. They have, yeah. The worst is a Cisco Street. Nobody knows how to say Cisco.
Well, you just told us, so thank you for that. Well, and you've been here in your home for more than 50 years. You've been in California most of your life. But you weren't born in this country. Tell me where you were born.
I was born in Viking, Alberta, Canada. My grandpa and his brother had a wheat ranch, and they went 7 years with no rain. And my mom was from England, and she was visiting a friend of hers in Canada. And my dad and my grandpa went to a dance. Well, my mom was at the dance. They ended up going to get married. Then I was born, and 2 years later, they came to the United States. And they said, my grandpa settled in Marysville, and Uncle Charlie and my dad was in Maricopa.
And I didn't know this, you told me, because I've interviewed plenty of people who weren't born in this country and then came here and maybe even earned their citizenship by serving in World War II. You said you were automatically made a citizen because you came to the States before you turned two? That was the rule back then?
Before you turn your 2 years old, you're automatically an American citizen. But that's not the way now.
And you grew up in a place called Maricopa. What was that childhood like? This is during the Great Depression in the 20s and early 30s.
Well, my dad worked there, and I can remember back in the 30s, 27, 28, 29, 30s. He worked every day. He never lost any work. In 1927, I remember he bought a brand-new Chevrolet car, no side curtains, and, you know. And then in 29, he turned around and bought a brand-new Whippet. So he was never out of work. It was an oil town, all oil. That's where the Lake Crew Gusher was that blew in. And I forgot how many million barrels spewed out of that thing in 1 year. It ruined the oil field, you know. There were a lot of things down there. It's changed, you know. It's like everything else. It changed the streets, it's, you know.
But you said that word oil, and you've been around oil most of your life.
Yeah, I have. I worked for a burial company for the oil, and then I was in Mobile for a while. Then when I hit oil at Clama, well, I'd come up here, and, well, I was a field operator number one, you know. Well, my job was to, for ARCO, was to, when the engine quit, if I couldn't start it, then I called a mechanic, and the mechanic done it. A lot of little things you had to do, keep the water wells going.
And back to your childhood. So you're the oldest of three kids, growing up in Maricopa, and later on you moved to Taft and went through Taft High School. But I'm curious if you remember, as a boy, having some kind of ambition or dream, that thought of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do someday.
Well, when I went to school, I thought I was going to be a draftsman. Yeah. I spent 4 years in high school learning how to be a draftsman and 1 year in junior college. But they only taught it for what they taught in 6 years. I took in 5 years. So that other year, I went to join the service, join the Marines. But as for a lot of things, well, you so little you don't think about stuff. What you're going to do or what you're going to be, you just live from day to day.
Well, and something happened. You mentioned high school and junior college there. There's something that happened your first year at junior college that kind of changed the world a little bit, because you graduated Taft High School, 1941. December, a few months later, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were and how you found out about that?
I think we found out on the radio, because there weren't no television then. I just found out about the radio.
Was that alarming? Was that eye-opening? What was that like to get that kind of news?
Well, it was bad. It was bad, just like Russia is today. It's not right. Too many people die.
Well, when did it start to occur to you that you may be involved somehow in the war effort?
Well, they start drafting people, you know. You get the right age, they draft you. So I don't know why, I just said, well, I'm going to go join the Marines, and did. I was over 18. Since I joined the Marines, my brother, he was 17 years old, and he wanted to do the same thing. So Mom signed for him, and he went in. He was in the 3rd Division. He was at Guam.
And we're going to hear what you did at Saipan and Tinian. So the Kincaid brothers were a big part of what the Marine Corps did in the Pacific. You enlisted in the Marines. You made that choice. Did you know what you were getting into? What was that adjustment like to go from a civilian to a U.S. Marine?
Well, it's different. You got a schedule. It's rigorous. You go to San Diego. You walk and drill and drill and drill and walk. You got to get tough enough to handle it, see? I go down to L.A. the other, not long ago, down to San Diego, trying to find the air base, you know, stuff like that. It's changed. Everything has changed. I remember going in boot camp, the B-24 Liberator Bombers. Airfield was right next to the base, and they take off right over top of our barracks. Well, tents then. We lived in Tent City. During the war, there wasn't enough barracks to hold all the guys, so they put us in a bunch of tents. I've never found anybody tell me, but them B-24s, every time they took off, every day, they always took off with the bomb bay doors open. You could look up and see, and nobody seems to know why.
I've never had anyone mention that. I've interviewed a lot of B-24 guys, so I'll have to try to get that answer for you.
Yeah.
Was it challenging, your boot camp, your early training?
Well, yeah, it's rigorous. Get up early in the morning, walk, go to eat, just, you know, it's a lot of walking involved. You know.
What do you think motivated you? What drove you?
Oh, gosh, I really don't know. I just did it, that's all. I never thought much about that.
How did you feel about the idea of going overseas?
Well, you're a little apprehensive because you don't know what you're going to get into. You just don't know. They walked you on a big old ship. We went over on a USS President Monroe. It had a swimming pool in it. And the nurses and the officers would be in that swimming pool swimming, but us old listed men couldn't even get anywhere near it.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No. Nope, never had. I figured when we left the United States, the ocean was rough. And I remember watching the big old destroyer escorting us, and that destroyer would be underwater 1 second and up on top of the water the next, just under and up. And I got to guard duty at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was up in the battleship, they gave me, and I started getting a little seasick. So I laid down. The captain guard come by, and Mr. Kincaid, you awake? Yeah, I'm okay. I just feel a little woozy. Well, okay, but don't go to sleep, because I heard later on that, it wasn't on that ship. We was going from someplace else. It was on a Dorian. It was a ship that you overhaul ships in. They'd run a ship in the back of it and overhaul it and take it out. Well, it was all closed back up, and they made a boat out, and some guy went to sleep on guard to it, and we heard he got executed, but we don't know how much truth there was to it, because it's a death penalty if you go to sleep in the war zone. I mean, they didn't do that in civilian life, but it was pretty bad.
No pressure.
Yeah.
So you stayed awake?
Yeah, I stayed awake. I was all right.
Did you ever get seasick?
No. Yeah, on a fishing boat. Him and I went out on a fishing boat, and I got sick. No. Yeah. It was a birthday gift. The wife gave us for to go deep fishing out of San Simeon. Oh, man, we got sick. So I'd come back and give the money back to the wife.
Well, you know, people think of Marines, and they have certain ideas of what a Marine does, but there are a lot of different things a Marine can do. What was unique about your duties and your assignment?
When we left New Zealand, we went to Tarawa, but they didn't need us. I was in a, 18 combat Marines, combat engineers, but they didn't need us, so we didn't get off. So we went straight from there to Hilo, Hawaii, and we were there for, get the combo together. You've got to replace the guys that all shot, that were killed. You got to bring you back up to command, I remember while I was on there, the air base at Hawaii, there were Hellcats and Wildcats and Bearcats would strafe our village all the time, practice strafing. It was quite an ordeal,
With real bullets?
No, no, no. They just dive at you, you know. Just, you know, make you, you know, to do that, see. Because we was there on Liberty for, what was it, months, 6-7 months. And I wanted to say I had Liberty. So I went down to the Naval Yard, and got a tour, went around the sub that had just come back from mission. So it's very interesting to go inside of one of them things, you know.
Those World War II subs aren't like the ones we have today.
No, 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 no. They're small, you know. Like where the periscope is, the table where they eat, and when they eat, when they get to eating, the table's all gone. You know, it's just not like some of these ones you see on television, see? Well, we had a guy, old Churchill. He was the boss of the electrician department, and I didn't know until later, but he was a tall guy, too, and he was a submarine commander. And they went on a mission and done, you know, some special deal, and they were supposed to take the conning tower off of that sub and make it a memorial. But I don't know if they did, but I didn't know he was a sub guy left. He's gone. So many guys they did a lot of things in the war, but you don't know it. You don't know to read their obituaries and find out, you know, what they did.
That's why I do this program.
Yeah.
So we hear stories from guys like you and not read the, well, he never talked about it.
Yeah.
You know, we want to hear these stories. They're valuable. They help us understand the price that was paid for our freedom. And you mentioned something else there. You said with those 18th Combat Engineers, part of the 18th Regiment of the 2nd Marine Division, that you guys arrived at Tarawa, or some people say it Tarawa, but
yeah.
That was one of the bloodiest battles in the Pacific in November 1943. I'm sure you've studied about that battle. You know some of the stuff that happened there.
Yeah, I've got a lot of pictures of it too, see? Yeah. But we never got off the ship. But we sat there all night long and watched the battle wagons shell it, you know? And them shells would come out of them big 14-inch shell guns, and they're red hot. They don't have tracers, but it's hot from the...
So you're a 21-year-old kid halfway around the world on a ship, and this is the show you're seeing, is all these shells going in on a tiny little area of land.
Yep, it was. Yeah, I think it was one mile wide and a couple of miles long.
Uh-huh.
But it took 3 days to secure it, see?
Also cost a lot of lives.
The tide was out just about, but the Amtraks and the amphib boats that haul the boys in there, and then they'd shoot them, and they'd have to walk some of them. In the water. The water's so shallow, they'd walk clearly out. And them guys out there, and the Jeffs out there was pecking them off as they're walking in the water to get there.
You could see that, too?
You could see it from our ship, yeah. They'd drop a mortar shell right inside of a Higgins boat and poof, or Amtrak, and it'd disappear.
Well, and that was one of the painful lessons learned in that battle, was that those coral reefs were going to be a problem. And later on, they'd go blow up some of those reefs so that the boats could get further in.
Well, yeah, that's where the demolition guys come from, see?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Sit on that deck on the day and watch boats come back with the wounded, just one after another. Guys all shot up.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at here, because I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. This had to be hard to see. I mean, this is your first taste of combat. You're not participating, but you can see what's happening to your fellow Marines.
Yeah, we did. We saw it all. I know there's a colonel. Colonel got shot, and the bullet hit him right in the helmet and went right around, never killed him. It hit the metal and went right around inside the helmet. And it was after that they come out with a law that they wouldn't have no insignias. The officers didn't have no bars on them, so they could know who to shoot and who not to shoot.
Well, and just, you know, from a human perspective, an emotional perspective. How did you process that? How hard was that to watch what you were seeing there?
Yeah, it's hard to watch, yeah. It's hard, but you could do nothing about it. That's just it, you know. You just had to do it. You had no control over it.
You know, was it a relief not to be called into action there? Was that painful to know that maybe you guys could have helped? Or how did you feel about your guys being there but then not being needed?
Well, you felt good that you didn't have to go out and get, you know, didn't have to go and get shot at or something like that. But you still felt sorry for the guys that were there. There's just, like, I think they killed 2,400 men right there in 3 days.
And you said you saw some of those wounded coming back.
Lots of wounded. And then a lot of dead bodies floating in the water. Japanese bodies, American boys. Yep. Yeah, and they're hoping they don't do it again.
Yeah, and I don't want to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head. I'm just curious if, again, you're a 21-year-old kid watching all this. When you see that, is there anything inside of you that says, hey, that could be me?
Oh, yeah, it could be me. If you're there, it could be. Yes, it could be. Because I know a lot of guys there that didn't make it. after we got to Hawaii, I met a guy there that he didn't have a shirt on. And a sniper got him, and he shot him right in the chest, and his heart was a-beating. And as the heart, you know, wasn't pumping, the bullet went by, missed his heart, then his heart pumped, and then his heart went over, oh, you know, where the hole went through, see? And that you could see the hole in his chest, and you look at his back, and there's a hole in the back. And then when we went to Saipan, he got killed. It's just, you know, it's just weird how things happen.
Indeed it is, and sometimes it's kind of hard to make sense of it all. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear about more of the history that George Kincaid witnessed firsthand when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos and a short video with this soon-to-be centenarian. And I think we may have an answer for his age-old question about B-24s and those bomb bay doors. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old George Kincaid of New Cuyama, California. He served with the 2nd Marine Division in the Pacific during World War II, and thanks to his friend Bob Quirk for letting me know about George and his story. Remember when he was talking about his initial Marine Corps training in San Diego and how he often saw B-24s taking off with the bomb bay doors open and never knew why? Well, I consulted some of my favorite pilots, and here's what I found out. B-24s leaked fuel, so crews often flew with the bomb bay doors slightly open to dissipate potentially explosive fumes, is what I was told. May also have something to do with the ability to jettison bombs if you had an engine failure on takeoff. But an interesting note about the way the bomb bay doors were configured on B-24s, they did not create drag on the aircraft like they did on most bombers. So hope that helps there a little bit, George. We heard about how you enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1942 after a year at Taft Junior College in Kern County, how your younger brother followed you into the Marines not long after, and you said you were an eyewitness to the bloody battle for Tarawa, or Tarawa as some people say, late 1943, but your unit didn't have to get into the fighting there. And let's pick it up from there.
After Tarawa? Yeah. Yeah, we went to Hawaii. We sat there for months, and then we went to Saipan. Saipan and Tinian.
Had you ever heard of Saipan before?
Nope.
Well, so tell me about what you experienced there, and in an engineer outfit, what your role in this invasion, in this landing was.
Well, we didn't have to do anything. The engineers, a lot of guys did. The demolition men was in there, and the truck drivers. But I turned out to be a Jeep driver. I was a adjutant Jeep driver, and I had a buddy of mine in Texas, L.B. Ross. He was a colonel Jeep driver, Colonel Volt, and I had Captain Ricks. And I had the Jeep to do anything I wanted to. If he wasn't driving the Jeep, I did. And, of course, this is after the fighting was over with, see? And I was on there when the first B-29, they just took this place for a bomber base. And so they knew they could fly from Saipan and Tinian all the way to Japan and back. So I remember when the first B-29 landed, I got the Jeep, went down, and I saw it. And I crawled through it. In it, went in the tail back and forth in the tunnel, see, B-29, see. And then from our barracks where we lived, or Tent City where we lived, you could see the fighter strip, and you could see the P-38s. So we go down and watch P-38s take off and land. You know, stuff like that. I remember one day, everybody's out there waiting. A jet bomber went over, and this P-47 was already on the ground, and he was heading for the bomber. And the P-38 was on the ground, and he took off and shot the bomber down before the P-47 could get to it. He just come right up underneath the bottom of it. And then something that always bothered me was I've been to a dozen different air shows around here, every air museum, and I've never seen a night fighter, P-61 night fighter. I don't know where they're at. They never salvaged any, I guess, because I remember when they brought those down, brought them and landed one. We went down and looked at it. That's just a flying fortress, 50-mile machine guns, oh, gosh, and radio control. Yeah. And nighttime we'd hear a bomber. Airplane go over, and you sit there and wait, and then out to sea, you'd see a big ball of fire. He'd take off, go out there and shoot him down. You'd see him plane falling down. He'd not try to paint it coal black, just black as they could paint it.
That's why they called it the Black Widow, right?
That's why they called it the Black Widow. But I never seen one in an air show. There was there. We looked all over that one. March's Museum and Chino, Benicino. They have fly-ins at Santa Maria. We just went to Casmeda, to that museum here last year. But it was just everything was real quiet. All of a sudden, you look out there, and there that ball of fire is coming down.
You know, there's something about Saipan that I'm curious if you witnessed firsthand, or maybe you just heard about it. But a lot of the guys I've interviewed who were there talk about, you know, a real unfortunate element of the capture of that island, which was what the Japanese forces were telling the civilians, how they lied to them and said that, you know, what you Americans would do to them.
I saw that. They jump off cliffs. They hold a baby in their arms and just poof, draw they go.
And you watched that with your own eyes.
Yeah, we watched it. Yeah, we watched it, yes.
It was called Marpy Point, the suicide cliff there, yeah.
They commit suicide. That's even an army lieutenant or officer. If he does something wrong, he kills himself. If he loses his battle or something, you know, Harry Carey, little bitty old sword, you know.
I mean, I know you've been living with this for almost 80 years, but that's so jarring to a lot of our senses that a woman would grab her child and jump off a cliff because whatever's been put into her head was so much worse than that. How hard was that to watch, and how angry did that make you to see that happening?
It hurts. It makes you turn around and walk away. You don't want to watch it anymore. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they just brainwash them. What, you know, but we didn't hurt nobody. I know they built, on Saipan, after they first hit, we built a stockade for the civilians. Just a bunch of fence, you know, barbed wire. But they were never abused.
Being the adjutant's Jeep driver on Saipan, what was that life like? What were some of the assignments you had, some of the places you had to drive? Was there some inherent danger in that job? What was it like?
I'd have to take him to where he wanted to go. One day he said, hey, let's go for a ride. And I took him down to main headquarters. He went in there and got the 18th Marines, or payroll, $60,000. And he threw it at me, and I had it and put it down, you know. And we got paid in $2 bills. Yep, they wanted where the money went, so he paid everybody $2 bills. So where could the money go, see, on Saipan? The pilots would have to haul it off. Because I remember one day there, the radio man said, George, you want to go for a ride? Yeah, okay. And he knew a guy. Well, they had a painting, a painting of a room with a bar. And there was a bar on it. People leaning up the bar drinking beer. And there's four men on one side, four men there, and a woman was in the middle of the bar, see, sitting in the middle. And the guy on one side had his hand on the cheek of her butt, and the guy on the other side had it on the cheek of her butt, and they rolled up a canvas. We got to take this to Guam. So we went down, got in a C-47, and went through to Guam. This guy that I went with, he flew it back, flew it over the lady, and went on the way back. He let me fly it back. But it's pretty hard to make an airplane fly level if you never flew one before, you know.
So you'd never flown before, but he was crazy enough to let you fly it.
Yeah, I had a stick and I was flying it with a control, see. Uh-huh. But he was over there to be sure it went straight.
That sounds like quite a thrill.
That's quite an experience. It was, yeah. Because when I was on Hawaii, before we went to Saipan, I took that tour on that, went to look through the stub. Well, I also went down to the airbase and went for a ride in SBD Dauntless Dive Bomber. If they put a new engine in one, they got to test fly it. If they work on a machine guns, they got to take it out and test fire. See, he took us up to 5,000 feet and just peeled off in a dive. No, he went to 7,000 feet. And then, like you said, we're going to dive bomb that building. And he peeled off and straight down. And I looked at the altimeter on that plane, 20,000 feet, you know, and stuff. And boy, that thing was just like a clock unwinding. And he pulled it out right straight up. And then he went straight up and rolled it. I didn't get sick, but dang near it, you know, because it was rough. Later on, he dropped down and like he was going to machine gun something, you know, and he was on top of the surf, and the palm trees is above the airplane. You can look out and see the palm trees, and you was above the palm trees, and he was right on the surf.
That's quite an e-ticket ride you got there.
Yeah, it was fun. Which, you know, haven't been in an airplane very. You know, that was the first. I think that was my first airplane ride because the other one was in Saipan.
Yeah, and you met, and Saipan and Tinian are often paired together because yeah. Tinian was taken right after Saipan. Did you have any different experiences on Tinian compared to Saipan?
No, I didn't. No, there wasn't much on Tinian because we used to go down in the morning. The B-29s would start taking off about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. They'd take one about. I don't remember now if it was 1 minute or one every 30 seconds, but the clock, 2 hours later, they're still taking off. They took thousands off there all the time. We'd watch them. One time, the plane took off. He couldn't get off the ground. He went out and lit in the ocean. And then we watched them come back from go down at 8 o'clock at night, and they'd be coming home. And you'd see a ball of fire out there. You know, you'd have an engine on fire. Sometimes they'd make it to the airport. Sometimes they'd land before they get to the airport. They had trouble with their engines on them. They were temperamental.
Well, that's why some of those places were important that they could. Like Iwo Jima and Guam, they could actually land there if they had trouble.
I think they could, if they couldn't make it to Saipan, I think they could land at Guam.
Well, and you told us something earlier that, you know, after you joined the Marine Corps, your little brother did too.
Yeah.
Were you getting any updates on how your brother was doing or where he was or any of that?
Nope. All I know is when he was on Guam, he got 2 days liberty and he flew over to Saipan where I was at and we visited for 2 days. Then he went back to Guam. Then I came home, and then he came home way later. I got home in January 46, and he never got home until middle of 47.
What was that like, hanging out with your brother that far away from home after everything the two of you had been through?
It was pretty good. It was a good feeling, yeah. When you left home, you didn't know whether you were going to get back or not. So then when you meet him over there, it was quite a deal.
And I'm just curious, what kind of stuff you talk about in a situation like that? Do you talk about some of the combat stories, or is that what you avoid and you focus on other things?
Well, I never did actually have to go to combat, you know. Of course, we had to learn things. I didn't have nothing to do with demolition, but they showed you how to use the flamethrower. We had, you know, stuff like that in case they did. And every flamethrower guy had a guy with him with a Browning automatic rifle, you know, BAR, to protect him. So it's just, well, you just sometimes you're lucky you make it home.
Yeah, are there some moments that you look back on and you say, you know, I'm lucky I made it through that, or somebody was looking out for me during that situation?
Oh, yeah, you think back, yeah. Your mind goes back quite often about what went on. The closest thing, I think, was we were kept on Tinian, and it was right by a cornfield, and some guy was in there. He'd been in combat a lot. He went out there, and they didn't have no outhouses. He just went out in the corn patch and squatted. The first thing we know, blam, 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 the Jap was in there, and he shot him. I don't know if the Jap was dead yet. He took his rifle butt and smashed all his gold teeth out and reached his pocket, pulled out a tobacco bag, a little bit, and it's full of gold teeth. A lot of guys did that, except they got the gold. And then the Jap come running by the field, and everybody shot at him. And he was about 100 yards away. Nobody hit him. He kept, you know, he got away. That's the closest we come to any of us guys had to shoot. we were engineers, and you just didn't do it, see?
Was there anything else about being an engineer that stands out, other things that you guys were tasked with doing that you remember?
Well, I remember one thing, the tanks couldn't get in where they wanted to go. And so they took a bulldozer and used bulldozer to make a road for the cat, and a sniper got the cat operator. So they went and took some steel plating and made him a cage. So he and put that on the dozer where they couldn't get him, and so he ended up making a road for the tanks to get in there.
Yeah, being an engineer wasn't necessarily a safe job. I mean, a sniper can hit you just as well as anybody else.
Well, whatever you done, see? Truck drivers, Jeep drivers, you know?
And were you still on Tinian when the Enola Gay took off and dropped the atomic bomb?
Yep, well, I was there, yeah. Of course, we didn't know it. It was all secrecy, see? Because Enola Gay dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima. Then Boxcar dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. And then they, funny thing is, they quit fighting on my birthday. Yeah. August 14th. And I think 2 weeks later, we board ship, and 2 weeks later, we docked in Nagasaki.
And that's where he would witness things that very few people still with us today can say they saw with their own eyes. What did he see at Nagasaki, and how does that color his perspective as he approaches his 100th birthday this next VJ Day? We'll hear it in George's words when we come back. And if you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos of George then and now, and you'll even see a pretty unique piece of World War II memorabilia. It's a piece of a Japanese fighter plane, a Zero, but you might be surprised to see what George has fashioned it into. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable. Or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Sometimes you hear a voice on this program that makes you do a little bit of a double take. With George Kincaid of Nuquillama, California this week, you might be saying to yourself, he really doesn't sound like he's 99 and a half years old. No, he sure doesn't. And if you ever have the privilege of meeting Mr. Kincaid and shaking his hand, you might find out that he's actually related to Las Vegas Raiders quarterback Derek Carr. George never would have had the chance to watch Derek in silver and black if he didn't make it home from his World War II service as a Marine. And when we left off, he mentioned being sent to Nagasaki just 2 weeks after an atomic bomb had leveled a good portion of that city.
I was driving truck then, dump truck then, and we had unloaded ship, and the 6th Marine Division was on an airport, and you'd have to haul all the way there. And it seemed like Nagasaki, it was an ammunition factory, and every house was gone, nothing but the cement foundations, or, you know, like this house is, just a cement around, and half of those houses had a steel lathe in them. They did piecework for the factory. Well, the Army was there just before we did, and they, I think it was the Army, and they took all those lathes and put a tunnel. There was a tunnel about half a mile long to get through the mountain to get over to the airbase. So when you drive through that with a truck, there was all those lathes lined up in there. The railroad depot was right there. The bomb wiped out everything next to the airport that way, and this side of the airport, the town was okay. And we were just a couple of hundred yards from that in a schoolhouse. We lived in that schoolhouse till we come home. And I remember one day I had a little boy with a cat. And so I had to take this caterpillar to the 6th Marines. And I was driving down this rice paddy, narrow road, and here comes this Japanese civilian in a truck. Well, I couldn't go nowhere. I wasn't going to put that Army Marine Corps truck and trailer and cat in the ditch, see? So I just kept going, and he ran off in the ditch. And then I looked back, and I could see the steam coming off of it. So I stopped. I went back there. It was a man and his wife and two little kids. They were jabbering away. I couldn't understand. But I went up and looked at that truck. It was like an old 28 or 29 or 30 Model A, but there was no Model A engine in it. Did you ever see a Fairbanks Morse with the two wheels on the side? Two big wheels about this big around? Yeah. Well, that's what he had sitting there running that truck. A Fairbanks orange. Well, in other words, my grandpa had one just like pumping his water well. Two big old flywheels on the side. Yeah, and that was sitting there in that steam. It don't have a radiator. It just had a big bowl on top for a tank, see? And the water slushing out. And that's where the steam come from. And that's what he had.
He had a jerry-rigged steam truck.
Yeah. He had that fixed there where the shaft came out and went over to a bearing on the front frame. Well, this motor set up on top when he, you know, had a belt and stuff going down around that shaft. It's a weird setup, but it worked.
So were you able to help them?
No, I didn't do anything. I just went on down. When I come back, he was gone. It was an airport where they trained Japanese young pilots. They were taught to fly a glider before they got on an airplane. They had to fly this glider, see? And the weird part about it was, I built model airplanes when I was in high school, and they were all over the ceiling in my bedroom. And that glider that they had out there was the same thing I had that I built as a kid hanging on the ceiling. Yeah, same kind of glider, yeah. And they were all over the place.
You know, a couple things that come to mind. First, so you're on Tinian. This is not a very big island, and I assume news travels fast. Yep. So when Paul Tibbetts and the Enola Gay go drop that bomb on Hiroshima, they return to Tinian. How did you find out what had happened, and how mind-blowing was it to hear about this atomic bomb that no one knew even existed?
It was weird. Yeah, it was. It was. It was amazing. But you was relieved because you figured, well, they did that so we wouldn't have to invade. So they figured we'd lose millions of people to invading Japan. So it was a good feeling to know that it was over with, you know. But then they were stubborn and wouldn't do it, so they had to drop the other one.
Do you remember how that word kind of spread around the island, or what some of the things people were saying were, or what that felt like at the time?
No, it felt good, yes. It felt good, but everybody just talked about it. It was just all, well, that's great. That's, you know, everybody was glad. It was a change of the war real quick.
Do you think you would have been part of the invasion force if that invasion of Japan had happened?
Might have been, but we would have been way later. I don't think we would have been earlier.
So you hear about the bomb on Hiroshima, the bomb on Nagasaki, and then you go to Nagasaki. And you said just 2 weeks after the bomb was dropped, you were there?
Yeah, we were in there for 2 weeks.
So there's probably still some radiation floating around, right?
That's what I thought. I never got hurt, see?
You're almost 100 years old. I guess you're okay.
Yeah,
But because very few people were there to see what you saw. Certainly very few people are alive today who saw what you saw at Nagasaki. What can you tell us about what it looked like and what it felt like to look at it?
Well, it was amazing because you couldn't imagine anything could you be that destructive, because there was nothing there. Now, I see pictures of Hiroshima, and there's a lot of concrete buildings still standing. Well, Nagasaki, there wasn't none. It was an ammunition factory, and the metal framework that this factory is big is still standing, was still standing. But the covering it, the outside, what they covered it with, you know, metal or tin, Garpan, big buildings with old tin, full of holes from the bombs, see? But that was nothing. But the framework was still standing, and a great big monster smokestack was still there. Great big old, it must have been 100 feet tall or more, big 10-foot in diameter. It was still standing. But everything around for a dirt distance was gone. It was just flat gone.
I can't imagine trying to wrap your brain around that.
Yeah, that's it. It's just when you get there, you shake your head. Boys, you can't dream of something being so powerful, and yet the nuclear is worse than it is. The ones we got now are worse than atomic.
Yeah, what's your feeling about that? About the use, because you saw what it can do. I mean, and you know that there were people who were just disintegrated in an instant. So how do you feel about nuclear weapons now?
I think they ought to be banned. Shouldn't have them. But you know they are. North Korea, they got them. See, they shouldn't be allowed. Well, they're trying not to have them, too, you know. Russia's got them, we know.
And then you said something else. So your birthday's August 14th, and that's the day you get the news. Japan has surrendered. Yeah. This war is over. How did you get that news? Were you celebrating your birthday? Did they interrupt your birthday party tell you? How'd you find out?
Nobody had no birthday party over there. It's just come over the news, you know. You just hear it, you know, the radios. I never seen a radio. Nobody had a radio. They were in the office. It was all by telephone. I think the big we got the word and called us.
Well, was there a celebration?
Oh no! Well, yeah, just a lot of jumping up and down and hollering. I guess the guys that drank, you know. I didn't drink anything, you know. Seabees had a lot of, you got a tag for beer, and every time they'd go down and get beer, they'd punch a hole in it, and I always give mine away. The beer was always hot. The Seabees had ice coolers, and their beer was always ice cold, so the guys would get enough tags to get 10 cases of beer and have to take those over there, and they'd have to give them 10 cases of, five cases of hot, one for two. You'll give them two cases of hot beer, and they'll give you one case of cold beer, see? So that's what they did, two for one, see? And they'd have ice cold beer. Well, they had that parties like that quite often, but I just didn't drink. I mean, never did really develop a taste for it.
When you look back on those years you spent in the Marines, sounds like what, about 4 years you were in?
Yeah, just about three and a half.
Is there something you look back on and you say, you know, this was the most challenging aspect or the hardest thing to deal with for you?
The worst thing, the scariest thing that I did, it had nothing to do with the war, but I was driving the truck and it was loaded with ammunition. Everything from 45 to 20 millimeter, just full of ammo. I come around this corner and here was a big 18-wheeler pulling a trailer, and I had no place to go. So I drove off the road. It turned over one time. I remember laying down, wrapped my arm around the windshield, and had my eyes open. I'd seen the windshield just disintegrate and rolled over and lit on my wheels. So if it lit on a creek upside down, I wouldn't be here. But it lit on my wheels, see? Then my .45 fell out of my holster. I had a spring-loaded holster on my armpit, you know?
Right.
And it fell out. And I got to get that. And I bent down, and I just happened to reached down right to the right spot and picked it out of the water. But I had a pipe. I smoked a pipe way back them days. It's a pipe and a cigar. And a guy named Felix Caruso, he was a wood carver. And he carved this pipe, and he put the Marine Corps emblem on it. And he was so darn good that you could see the coil in the rope and the feathers on that little eagle on the emblem. And he put Mom and Dad in freehand on the side, and he put all the islands that we went to, didn't get out, but all the islands I had to stop at, you know. I couldn't find my pipe. I lost my pipe. I felt pretty bad about that. But then the next day, they brought the truck in. They went out and got all the ammunition up in the truck, and got the truck, and I went down the truck, and the seat wasn't in it. I looked in there, and there's a half inch of the pipe stem sticking up through a hole in the under the seat. So I saved it, you know.
You still have it?
Nope. Somebody stole it. We think somebody got it for drugs, you know, later years.
Yeah, it sounds like a priceless pipe.
It was. I realized his name was Felix Caruso, and his dream was to build a whole set of furniture, hand carve a whole set of furniture. I don't know whether he lived, he did or didn't. See, but he signed the bottom Kitty. That was his nickname, Kitty, Kitty.
Yeah, that's a pretty close call when you flip over an ammunition truck.
Come to it, see. I don't know how to swim, so you figure if the ship got torpedoed, it would be a little messy.
What was it like to come home after the war?
It was great. I got out of service New Year's Day, 46, and I got liberty and came home in December. Before I got discharged, I got liberty, and I come home and took my dad's car. He had two cars, a good car to work. It was a 39 Chevrolet, and I took it down with me to the base, and then when I got discharged, boom, and come home.
And did you know your wife before the war or no?
I didn't meet her after the war. After I got home, I turned around and went to Texas, because this guy that drove the Jeep, the other Jeep was a good friend of mine, you know, and he lived in Lufkin, Texas. So I went down and visited him, and I rode a Greyhound bus down, and it was such a miserable trip in that bus that I said, I'm not going to ride it back. So I give a guy $400 for a GI motorcycle, a Harley 45, no flat, it had 45. I gave him $400 and rode it home. And my mom, my wife always teased me because I sold a motorcycle for $400 to buy her wedding rings. $400 nothing today, but, you know, I still got it in her wedding ring in the box. And then we went back to visit him one day. He stayed in the reserve. I got out for good, but he wasn't, and they called him back in 52. He called him back, and he was in San Diego for a while. Well, we went down to visit him, and then we turned around and went down again. I was driving a 37 Pontiac, four-door sedan. And we drove down there, and he'd got discharged, sent home, but he hadn't got around telling us. He just didn't know he was coming down, see? I just got off Friday at 8 o'clock in the morning, drove down, and we turned around and come home, and we was right by San Clemente. We had a safety latch on the back doors. You couldn't open the back door as long as the front door was shut, but the safety broke. And I was batting along at about 55 miles an hour on the freeway. It was just about dark, and I heard a rush of wind. The back door opened up, and Doug, the oldest boy, fell out. He fell out in the highway. I looked in the rear mirror, and I saw him rolling sideways. So Mom picked him up, and there's a knot on the back of his head. There's about half a cantaloupe. So we poured a coal and drove on into Orange County to the Catholic Hospital. And they looked him over. Oh, he'll be all right. We said, what about that knot on the back of his head? Oh, he says, that's just blood. It'll go away in a few days, but we want to keep him for observation. So I says, oh, okay. And Mom asked me, says, do we have enough money to buy motels? And I says, well, I think so. And the doctor reached in his pocket, pulled out his wallet and said, you need some money? I said, no, I don't think so. So we didn't take it. But I often wondered, would doctors do that today? He reached in and gave us some money. And so we went back to hospital, and that knot was just about gone the next day. It was okay, and we left the money because I had to go to work Tuesday, and I got home with $13 in my pocket. So he was 2 years old and he's 6'6". That was a scary deal. And you know what's funny about that? We went easy on him his whole life. He never got a spanking. We never spanked that boy. I think just because of that reason. You didn't know, but it never hurt him. Knocked the skin off his elbow and his toes and heels from rolling down the blacktop. We're just like no cars behind him.
Was it him or Tim who went on the honor flight with you?
Yeah, him. Doug. Doug's the one that was on the honor flight.
Well, tell me about that honor flight. So you went with Honor Flight Kern County to Washington, D.C. What were some of the things you saw, and what did you get out of that experience?
It was great. We went to all the memorial services, and then it was raining, and they couldn't go to what else we wanted to see, so they just drove us up to the Smithsonian Air Museum. We went to the museum, and then we went on and waiting for the bus to pick us up, and a Brigadier General walked up. He had his stars on, and I never forget, his name was Tom Moore, and I worked with a Tom Moore out here. And he sat there and talked with us for 15 minutes, wondering all about what was going on. Young guy, didn't look like he had enough gray hairs to be a brigadier general, but he was.
What did you think about when you were at that World War II memorial?
where they've got 4,000 gold stars there, representing over 400,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war. What was going through your mind there?
It makes you very humble that many people, well, they died for their country.
Did you have any friends in the war who didn't come home?
Oh, yeah, a few. Yeah, there's a couple of guys in Maricopa. Taft, the guy I went to boot camp, never came home. Paulson, a guy from Taft, he never came home. I knew a lot of guys that did, you know, different people. Guy I went to work with, went to visit him all the time, him and his mom and dad. And he was in the war and did a lot of heroic things, and I didn't even know it. I went to visit with him a dozen times after the war. And then when I die and read obituaries, there it is. Well, a guy, he worked down at Plant 10. He's a foreman. Never heard much out of him, but it turned out he was a P-38 pilot and shot down a couple of planes. But you didn't know it. Till way later.
Well, with that in mind, is there anything else you think we need to know about your own time in the Marine Corps?
I had a lot of fun, but yet I wouldn't do it again. You know, that's it. It's just, we're lucky to be alive.
Well, and in about 5 months, you're going to hit the century mark here. Any big plans for when you turn 100?
Well, no, I guess I'll probably I know somebody's going to have a birthday party.
Well, I got a couple more questions for you. If there's anything else you want to add, you know, feel free. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
You're welcome.
Thank you for telling us this story. When you look back over almost 100 years, 99 and a half years, is there something you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I think I remember 72 years. That's what I look back at, and I miss her horribly. That's what I accomplished. And yet I got a fistful of medals for pistol shooting all those years. Nobody around in this town could beat me.
I want to follow up on something you said there. When I asked you what you were most proud of, you said being married to your wife for 72 years.
Yeah.
You lost her 3 years ago. You said you still miss her horribly. But I want to know for everybody listening, there's a lot of people listening who are married. They might have 20 years, 30, 40, 50, but they want to know the secret to being married that long, to enjoying that many years of marriage. So I'm sure you have a good answer for me on that. What was the secret for you guys?
Tell them you love them every day. I don't think people say that enough. And respect each other. Obey, it says. We never had no fights. I'd be afraid to fight her. She's pretty tough.
And so I asked you, looking back, what you're most proud of, but I want to ask you, too, looking forward, is there anything you haven't done yet in 99 and a half years that's still on your list that you want to do or you want to experience, you want to see?
You know what? I thought jumping out of a parachute. Yeah. I thought jumping out of an airplane. But I'd have to get a doctor's okay first because I don't know if my cow heart valve would fail. I got an aorta valve from a cow. It's a bovine valve from a cow. They said it was good. They would last for 4 to 10 years. Well, this is the fifth year. So I don't know how, you don't know. Still strong. Pumping strong.
Pumping strong. I think we can say that about George Kincaid, 99 years old, hitting the century mark this coming August. Who knows? Maybe we will get to see him jump out of an airplane. I'm just grateful he shared a few of his memories over the last hour. Don't forget to check out the photos and a short video with George at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We are out of time, but I hope you can join us again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.